Russian President Putin has ordered a drill to test the combat readiness of his armed forces. This amid tensions with the European Union and the U.S. over the fate of Ukraine. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Most of this Politics Wednesday focusing on the rapidly changing picture in Ukraine following the fall of its Moscow-backed president, Viktor Yanukovych. We'll ask this hour, how likely is a Russian military intervention? Also, the implications of budget cuts that will slash the U.S. Army to pre-World War II levels. Our analysts today, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University and Lindsey Kahn of the University of Northern Iowa, who's currently on leave working at the Pentagon. Join our discussion this Politics Day right after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day once again arriving on this Wednesday, and our focus for at least the first half hour, much of the hour, will be on the developments we've been hearing in our news at the top of the hour, developments in Ukraine and related developments. Joining us with analysis this week, Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, back in our Ames studio. Stephen Schmidt, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Lindsey Kahn is with us less often in our studio. Well, she's by phone. She is actually assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, though currently on leave as an international affairs fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, also working at the Pentagon in the Office of Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. Joining us by phone, Lindsey, welcome back.
Thanks. Always happy to be here, Ben.
And with the developments going on in Ukraine, your expertise is especially something that is of interest to us, Lindsey, both of you, of course. But let's start off with Ukraine. We heard in our news today, early this morning, our time, the Russian defense minister said that President Putin ordering a drill to test the combat readiness of his armed forces. A display of military might that comes amid these tensions with the European Union and the United States over the fate of Ukraine following the fall of its Moscow-backed President Viktor Yanukovych. Today's announcement did not mention the recent uprising in Kiev, but military drills are to be carried out in Russia's central and western military districts. It's the western part of Russia, which covers most of Russia's border with Ukraine. Hours after that, our Secretary of State John Kerry warning Russia must be, quote, very careful in judgments it makes about Ukraine. It must keep to its commitment to respect the sovereignty of the nation. And he said Putin should listen carefully to Ukrainians who have voiced their desire for change. This interesting quote from John Kerry, this is not Rocky IV. Believe me, we do not see it that way. John Kerry, our Secretary of State. Lindsey Kahn, let me go to you first of all. This announcement by the Russians, a signal for these war games, a bluff, or a real threat of possible military intervention?
I don't think we can rule out Russian military intervention, but I think the likelihood is below 50%. Certainly, it's a signal. Very much a signal, but I do not think that it is an overt threat. There are pros and cons involved for Russia in terms of an intervention. On the pro side, you know, unrest in Ukraine looks bad. It spreads instability. It could incite ethnic groups within Russia to engage in their own uprisings. Russia has a plausible narrative for intervention, you know, instability, ethnic Russians who might be oppressed, etc. And for them, no one's going to stop them. You know, if Russia rolls in with tanks, Europe and the U.S. will protest, but they won't go stand in the way. So that sounds bad. But on the con side, Russia has very little to gain from a military intervention in Ukraine. No new Ukrainian government is going to reject Russia entirely, and Russia has a virtual economic stranglehold on the Ukraine. They have significant debts to Russia. They usually borrow from Russia to pay those debts back. Default threatens serious inflation. Ukraine gets almost all of its energy from Russia. A huge number of Ukrainians depend on migrant worker visas to go work in Russia. You know, so basically, if I were Putin, I would, you know, indicate that I wanted them to work this out, but I would I think they benefit more from acting like the benevolent and disinterested neighbor while Ukraine sorts itself out and then exerting all their leverage on whoever the new government is.
River to River listeners, with these new developments in Ukraine, what are you concerned about? What are your questions and concerns? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Stefan, you've been watching this. What are your thoughts?
Have the Russians never used military force on their satellites?
Well,
that's my only thought.
I remember very well. 1956, 1968. Well, we have a list, don't we? Yes.
We have a list, and we have no pushback from Europe or the U.S. on any of those. I remember the Hungarian Revolution because when I was in college, there were a huge number of Hungarian freedom fighters who had been told by Eisenhower, go overthrow the Soviets and free Hungary, and they went out on the streets. And when they were halfway done with succeeding, the tanks rolled in, and the Soviets at that time, you know, just crushed them. And so, you know, obviously my view is that if things really look dangerous for especially the eastern part and Sevastopol and some of the military installations that the Russians have there, they're going to use military force. You
well,
know?
We have, of course, 1956, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, 1968 as examples, but we also have the Peaceful Revolution in the late 1980s, Poland, East Germany. I was in East Germany right when that revolution happened, and the Soviet Union was crumbling, and there was no intervention. So isn't it a question, Lindsay, of which this will be?
Oh, yes. And of course, I agree with Stefan that, as I said, you know, I wouldn't rule out intervention. And Stefan makes a very good point that Crimea is sort of a separate question. You know, Crimea used to be Russian territory. It was only turned over to Ukraine in 1954. And there are still Russian military installations in Crimea. And Crimea is also more than 75% ethnic Russian. You know, so I think that it's definitely fair to say that if Russian military installations are threatened in Crimea, or if, again, as I said, ethnic Russians are significantly threatened, that the Russians will probably make some kind of move. All I'm saying is that I think there are significant reasons to believe that the Russians are not just going to roll in the way they did in Georgia in 2008. As I said, it's a mixed bag, but I think they will wait and see if they feel that it's absolutely necessary. They don't benefit from rolling in right now.
In Ukraine today, police struggling to keep apart two rival groups. The regional parliament was to hold a crisis session on this latest turmoil. That gathering resulted in competing rallies. 10,000 Muslim Crimean Tatars rallied in support of Ukraine's interim leaders, and they waved Ukrainian flags, chanting, "Ukraine is not Russia," and "Allah Akbar," while a smaller pro-Russian rally nearby calling for stronger ties with Russia, waving Russian flags. And this is what that scene sounded like. So a little bit of the sound from those protests I just described. Increasing speculation, this latest round of turmoil might result in the partitioning of Ukraine. Western areas of the country looking towards the European Union. Eastern areas maintaining close ties with Russia. A valid fear, Lindsay, do you see it breaking apart for the reasons you and Stefan have just described?
I think, again, like intervention, it's a possibility. I personally put the likelihood of an all-out civil war as fairly low, but I put the likelihood of long-term governmental weakness and low-level violence at very, very high. And again, if there's going to be any effective separatism, it will be in Crimea. Crimea's already got some autonomy, and they will push for more. I mean, if you look at maps of Ukrainian election results and maps of Ukrainian language is the easiest way to separate them. They're very, very starkly separated between the East and West. But I think that, you know, unless a new unless a new transitional government were to impose really harsh measures on ethnic Russians, that most of the people in eastern Ukraine would not see any kind of advantage in splitting. But there would be, I think there would be a significant danger in Crimea.
Mm-hmm. Allah Akbar, they were yelling, Ukrainians. I'm sure Putin is really very happy with that, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's the slippery slope down into Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fear that the Russians have always had of, you know, their Muslim former republics. And, you know, I mean, I think Putin is probably pretty concerned about how this is all going to end. And you don't have to send in the Russian tanks. You can send in what amounts to the same thing as special forces. And, you know, the Russians have a very long history of very good clandestine operations, and they probably have a very deep network of agents that are already in Ukraine. And I think those are the ones that, if things start really crumbling and falling apart, they're going to start taking action.
River to River listeners, as we watch developments in Ukraine, what are your concerns? What are your questions? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPRTalk, or find us on Facebook to post a question or a comment. That phone number again, 1-866-780-9100. Politics Day, and of course on Politics Day, we follow the latest political developments. They happen to take us overseas this week, also last week, as the Ukrainian crisis continues. Lindsey Kahn is with us, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, currently on leave working at the Pentagon. Stefan Schmidt in our Ames studio, university professor of political science at Iowa State University. Give us a little bit more, Lindsey Kahn, of the perspective of the U.S. and the EU in this. Of course, for Russia, this is not only on their doorstep, it's practically in their front yard, what's happening in Ukraine as a mm-hmm. major former Soviet republic. What's going on in the minds of our diplomats, our geopolitical thinkers in Washington?
Ukraine is also, of course, on the front doorstep of the European Union. It's right next to Poland and has a lot of historical ties with Poland as well as the Baltics. So both the EU and the US are very concerned about these developments. Ukraine had been moving towards fairly solid democracy, but they've always been under a significant amount of Russian influence, and we know that, and we live with that. I think what the U.S. is most concerned about and what the EU are most concerned about is primarily stabilization and hoping to put Ukrainian democracy back on track in a way that does not require, and this is what Secretary Kerry has said. I hadn't heard the Rocky quote, but I've heard him say
that came just minutes ago, actually.
Okay. But in other, you know, in other venues, he has said, we have no desire to force Ukraine to choose between Russia and the West. It's not in anybody's interest to force Ukraine to do that. That, however, is sort of unrealistic insofar as Russia seems to think that Ukraine needs to choose between Russia and the West. And, you know, I think that the U.S. and the EU are looking at this and wondering what they can do to help, and maybe what they can do to help is not much. Mm-hmm. They can certainly offer, threatening sanctions on the Yanukovych government was, you know, a decently smart move, trying to give moral support to the protesters. Now, I think all they can do is offer aid and reconstruction once a government is formed. But they really have to be careful. If we're going to warn Russia to be careful and think about what it's doing, we can't fall into this constant American trap of warning other people to be careful and then, you know, barging in ourselves.
1-866-780-9100. Politics Day, talking at the moment about the crisis in Ukraine, American interests there. Let's go to Jim in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi. This scares me to no end. My wife, may God keep her close, grew up in Kislovodsk, Russia, just very, very close to that area. Not 10 years ago, we were looking to get her parents out because Islamic separatists, specifically the Chechens, had announced plans to form the Islamic Republic of the Northern Caucasus. They'd gone so far as to send out what could only be called reconnoiter teams, drawing bridges and stuff like that to plan what would happen when the war took over. The slave markets in Chechnya were still running not 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. They were kidnapping people from, originally it was just the local settlements, but they moved up to Moscow. They were kidnapping people there.
So in this latest setting, Jim, do you have a question about the concerns that they can draw on the political expertise our guests have?
Well, my concern is, are they really thinking that these Muslims saying that Ukraine, not Russia, are really thinking that they're not going to try to split off later? It's one thing to try to split off of Russia to form an Islamic Republic. It would be quite a different matter to split off and form an Islamic Republic from Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lindsey Kahn, you commented on that earlier. These are Muslim Crimean Tatars.
Yeah.
We heard in that protest saying Allah Akbar. Tell us more about this group and the Crimean region.
The Tatars are a group of people who lived in the region. They have lived in the region for hundreds of years, were conquered by the Russians, again, hundreds of years ago, and have been in some ways, you know, oppressed by the Russians. But I think to go to your caller's concern, obviously, Muslim separatism in Caucasus regions and the southern regions of and the western regions of the former Soviet Union, that's always a concern, and the Chechens in particular sort of flare up every now and again. I think your particular concern about splitting off and forming a Muslim republic in Crimea is potentially misplaced, because what these particular individuals are arguing is that they don't want to split off from Ukraine at all. They want to stay Ukraine. The people who want to split off from Ukraine are the ethnic Russians, who want to either have independence in Crimea or join up with Russia again, as they were before the 1950s. Now, let's push this a little further. If, let's say, the ethnic Russians do split Crimea off from Ukraine, then I think you might see a significant independence movement showing up among the Tatar inhabitants, because they hate the Russians, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a tiny group. It's not a very big group. That doesn't mean they couldn't, you know, cause some damage, but they're a tiny group.
I wonder if either of you know any more of the background on this Crimean region that was part of Russia than deemed part of Ukraine. I read that it was a bumbling Nikita Khrushchev who handed it over to Ukraine. That was one characterization of it. And any other knowledge on that?
Khrushchev bumbling? I can't believe it.
Okay, perhaps not. We'll go back. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about other international developments and perhaps come back to Ukraine as our callers perhaps would desire. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Speaking with reporters yesterday, U.S. Press Secretary Jay Carney said President Obama has told Afghan President Hamid Karzai that he asked the Pentagon to draw plans to have all U.S. forces out of Afghanistan by the end of the year, because Karzai has so far refused to sign a bilateral security agreement allowing U.S. forces to stay.
The fact that President Karzai has indicated that it is unlikely he will sign the BSA means that if he doesn't sign it, it is at least possible that a successor Afghan government might sign it, but that pushes us later into the year. And the longer we go without a signed BSA, the by necessity, the more narrow in size and ambition the mission for a post-2014 force would be.
U.S. Press Secretary Jay Carney. At the same time, the president left open the possibility that U.S. troops might stay beyond April, which the U.S. has set as a deadline for a signed bilateral security agreement. Stefan, talk about this bilateral security agreement. This has been going back and forth in the news, and Hamid Karzai's refusal to sign it. What's at stake here? What's going on?
Well, mostly what's going on is that President Obama doesn't have a foreign policy. I mean, I'm not a Republican critic of the president's, but John McCain is, and a lot of others are asking, well, what is the Obama policy? I mean, it's to cut the U.S. military forces anyway, shift away from the region that we've been embroiled in, and pivot to the east and to the Pacific. You know, I guess pivot to the east is and to the Pacific is the only foreign policy that we can think of. He's completely messed up the situation in Syria, which is a massive human rights disaster with really no American policy towards Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to go back to Ukraine and to Putin and so on, puts every other foreign policy dilemma in the world into grave danger, because I don't think other countries think the U.S. has much of a foreign policy agenda. And I know that, you know, Lindsay is at the Defense Department and the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations and so on. Maybe she can ask our good friends at the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, what the Obama foreign policy actually is, because most of us can't really nail it down. And the situation in Afghanistan is just basically, you know, we weren't able to convince, you know, the Afghans into allowing American troops to stay there. And so we're just going to bug out. And
Stefan, we've got a couple minutes before a break. I want Lindsay's perspective on this very question, now that you dangle it out there so enticingly.
Yes. I think that, you know, President Obama would probably say that his foreign policy is to try to disengage from a lot of these things, that in fact is the policy. Now, whether you agree with that or not, or whether you think that's a good idea or not, is a different question. As far as the BSA goes, as Stefan pointed out, we negotiated this bilateral security agreement to take over from our informal agreement with the Afghan government that's running out at the end of 2014. And we wanted to extend the troop presence and shift the mission from a combat mission to a train, advise, and assist mission with a counterterrorism component. One thing we wanted was that U.S. troops remain under U.S. military jurisdiction rather than Afghan jurisdiction. That's a standard thing that we always ask for when we have troops in another country. And that was one of the problems with the BSA with Iraq as well. But another issue, and the one that Karzai is pushing back on, is that we wanted U.S. troops to still be allowed to carry out nighttime raids for the counterterrorism mission and, quote-unquote, for their own security. Karzai is pushing back on that because, well, he says he's pushing back on it for one reason. I think the main reason he's pushing back on it is because he is looking ahead to the time when the U.S. really won't be there anymore. He's also looking to negotiate with the Taliban, and he's trying to play both sides right now. You know, he's trying to negotiate or navigate or play us off each other and get the best deal he can. And he thinks that the U.S. is bluffing about leaving. He thinks that they will stay.
We have about just about 30 seconds before a break. Very quick, Lindsay, the two paths here, with or without this military presence under this agreement, how much of a difference would it make? Afghanistan is imploding, isn't it?
I think it'll make a big difference. Both the Afghan National Security Forces, the Parliament, and Pakistan are all worried that a pullout of all NATO troops will leave Afghanistan at the mercy of internal tensions and may result in a massive civil war. Now, leaving 8,000 troops, you know, will that keep everything on a steady track? Not clear, but it would be better than nothing.
It's Lindsay Kahn is with us, assistant professor of political science at UNI, currently on leave at the Pentagon. Stefan Schmidt, university professor of political science at Iowa State University. When we come back after a short break, let's talk about these budget cuts that will slash, for instance, the U.S. Army to pre-World War II levels. What are your concerns about that? What are your feelings? Lost jobs, perhaps here in Iowa as well. 1-866-780-9100. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, a conversation with neuropsychiatrist and best-selling author Dr. Daniel Siegel. He's the author of Parenting from the Inside Out and The Whole Brain Child. Tomorrow I'll talk with him about his latest book titled Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Explains how our teenage brains navigate the adolescent years and how that navigation has a direct impact on how we'll live the rest of our lives. An alternative view of the teenage brain tomorrow over the noon hour. Today, we're navigating politics as we like to do on Wednesday. And this Wednesday, it happens to be mostly international politics with the crisis in the Ukraine and pronouncements lately by Russia to have war games on the border of Ukraine, announcing that, and the reaction of Secretary of State Kerry, talking about that in our first half hour. Let's start off with our guest, Lindsey Kahn, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, currently on leave at the Pentagon, and Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, by talking about, well, domestic news that is also international in flavor. At a news conference on Monday at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel outlined some of the recommendations for dealing with cuts to military spending while also holding off on some decisions.
The reality of reduced resources and a challenging and changing strategic environment requires us to prioritize and make difficult choices. Some of those choices we must make now. For other choices, particularly those involving the ultimate size of our armed forces, we have built decision points into our budget plan. We will make these decisions when we have more clarity regarding future spending levels.
Cuts are quickly criticized. Speaking on Fox News to Sean Hannity, Vice President Dick Cheney calling the cuts absolutely dangerous and recalling his time as Secretary of Defense.
It does enormous long-term damage to our military. They act as though it's like highway spending. You know, you turn it on and off. The fact of the matter is he's having a huge impact on the ability of future presidents to deal with future crises that are bound to arise. And I've told you, Sean, a story about right after Desert Storm when I was Secretary of Defense after we won, the first thing I did was call former President Reagan out in California and thank him for everything he'd done back in the 80s to build that magnificent force we had for Desert Storm. I can guarantee you there's never going to be a call from a future Secretary of Defense to Barack Obama to thank him for what he's done to the military. This is just devastating.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney, join our discussion as we talk about the military cuts in our news. 1-866-780-9100. What are your questions? What are your concerns for our analysts this week? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Lindsey Kahn, you're there at the Pentagon on leave from the University of Northern Iowa. Can you give us an idea of what these cuts are, what they mean, a big picture view of what's being proposed here?
Yeah. I do have to say, I think former Vice President Cheney's comments are sort of disingenuous. Everyone agrees that there needs to be a drawdown of some kind, and the problem and the reason that the cuts are happening the way that they are is that Congress imposed sequestration, which tied everyone's hands and required across-the-board cuts. When the Pentagon or even certain members of Congress try to reduce military or veteran benefits, they're overturned because it's never in the interest of an individual member of Congress to make the military and veterans communities angry. It's kind of silly to say that, you know, President Obama sat down and decided he was going to screw the military. That's not what's happening here. And I think Secretary Hagel has made it pretty clear that the point that he's making is to Congress, if you don't like this, lift sequestration. But in terms of what's actually being done, you know, and whether Congress decides to do that or not is obviously up to them. But it's not honest to claim that this is somehow the master plan of the administration. Overall, what are they cutting? Primarily manpower. They're cutting end strength. And the reason for that is that personnel costs are completely out of control in the military. Everyone agrees on that. But it's almost impossible to cut benefits and pay and things like that. It's just very, very difficult to do that, both politically and practically. So the only way to cut personnel costs is to cut personnel. The other things that are being cut is some larger programs, some fairly expensive programs. The number of littoral combat ships will be fewer than was originally planned. The Air Force is going to try to phase out the A-10, although there is a member of Congress who is going to try to block that. The ground combat vehicle is being canceled. So some big programs like that, but it's primarily going to be a cut in personnel and a cut in sort of major programs. And if Congress blocks those things, then the cuts are going to come primarily from training and readiness, because that's the only place left to cut.
Stephen Schmidt, how do you see how these cuts are playing politically? And also, please react to former Vice President Cheney's remarks, criticism of President Obama.
Well, Cheney understands politics, and obviously you want to stick Obama with this. What I don't understand is why Obama, who is in charge, you know, hasn't pinned it on the Republicans. You know, if you don't want to raise more revenue, and we're kind of flatlining on revenue, we've got to cut everywhere, and the military is a big chunk of the federal budget, and entitlements are the other big part, and we got to cut everything. You know, there's nothing. Probably the U.S. military could use a little trim, you know. I mean,
yeah,
we have so much stuff, you know, that is experimental, that isn't working, new ships that were built. The Coast Guard launched a whole new fleet that was supposed to be light and powerful, and they turned out to be pretty disastrous vessels and, you know, highly sophisticated fighter-bomber aircraft that operate almost like robotic computers and choke the oxygen off of the pilots. Those are all not things that strengthen American defense. I mean, they're very expensive toys, and a lot of them probably can be retired. But politically, you know, Lindsay is right. You know, who wants to cut spending on military families and military households, right, and PXs and so on? Nobody wants to do it. So.
And to get a local view, Governor Branstad pushing back against these proposed cuts to the federal defense budget. He said yesterday he's seeking to deliver a letter to the president signed by every governor expressing displeasure with the proposed budget. He's just returned from Washington, where he attended a meeting of the National Governors Association. He co-chairs that association's council advising the Pentagon and Homeland Security. Colonel Greg Hapgood, a spokesperson for the Iowa National Guard, says it's not clear how the proposed cuts could impact the Iowa National Guard. A programming note here, Colonel Hapgood of the Iowa National Guard will be on our program, is scheduled to be on our program on Friday, to talk about this very subject. But when we talk about reshaping the military, Lindsey Conn, what is the thinking about the Pentagon, about what makes sense going forward? You said, you know, cuts in personnel. We're entering a period of cyber weapons, cyber security, cyber warfare. Is that the direction we're going?
I personally am always skeptical of the claim that you don't need a lot of people because you now have toys. I'm not a believer in that kind of thinking. At the same time, we certainly can do a lot more with fewer people now than we could do. You know, you see in the news everyone saying, oh, we're cutting the army down to the smallest since right before World War II. The implication being that we're cutting back to that level of capability. That's not true. We can do a lot more with fewer people now than we could then. End strength needs to come down. You know, we had a huge, for lack of a better word, surge in personnel during these two long, large-scale military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's time to draw that strength down. We don't need all of those people. But it's always dangerous to cut large numbers of personnel just because that's the only place you can. It's difficult to cut military personnel in an efficient way anyway, because you can't just cut the low performers and, you know, do lateral hires to fill in their jobs. You can't just hire somebody new to fill in a job in the military. You have to work them from the bottom up. So this is always relying on attrition and relying on cutting recruiting. These are inefficient ways of managing personnel. Unfortunately, and everyone at the Pentagon realizes that, unfortunately, they don't have any choice. It's the only way that they can do it. Sequestration has a timeline, right? There are time requirements on this. They have to cut a certain amount in a certain time. So what happens is, no matter what you think ought to be cut, as Stefan pointed out, you know, there are a lot of things that could be cut. But no matter what ought to be cut, if you have to cut a certain amount within a certain time, you cut what you can, not what you should.
Okay, let's quickly get to a couple of people who want to chime in on the topic of military cuts. Tom in Van Horn is listening and now on our program. Tom, hi. Welcome to our program. What do you want to throw into the mix?
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask why, as soon as this came out, they're talking about cutting retirees, pensioners, money, pay on the military. They're always talking about the troops, cutting the troops, money, the pay. Now they're going to reduce the troops. But we spend over $500 billion a year on the Department of Defense. So every 2 years we're spending $1.2 trillion. Can't the Congress come out and say, no, you make our promises whole to the troops. Let's keep the troops. Let's get rid of the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, that doesn't work, and we spent over $1.5 trillion on it, and it's not deployed yet. They're building Abrams tanks that the Pentagon has told the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, the Army has told them they don't want, but they're still building them because of the congressional district they're being built in, this jobs and this and that. There's so many things that you could stop without it, but it gets everybody's hackles up when you start saying, we're going to attack the troops, or we're going to take away from the troops. Everybody gets patriotic. They don't realize that big bottomless black hole that we shovel money into with a bulldozer every day, that the Pentagon, they're still getting their money for the military-industrial complex is making theirs, but they're putting it on the backs of our troops.
Tom from Van Horn, thanks for that view. Let's quickly go to Rob in Conrad. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. What's your take on this?
I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts, because I know, you know, one of the big issues, especially since the rise of the Tea Party, is there's a huge focus on the national debt, but it seems like every time that one of these issues comes up where, you know, somebody suggests a fairly substantial cut, that, you know, instantly, in this case, like the right wing with their base, they get them fired up and kind of kill any momentum for it. Or if somebody comes along and says, well, we need to actually finally reform these entitlements that, you know, take up 45% of our budget each year, then, you know, the left will come back and say, well, we can't put this on the backs of our seniors. So it just seems, I'm curious, is there any real consensus issues that we could actually reduce the debt on, or is it just kind of a, you know, political hot potato where they shift it back from one to the other?
Robin Conrad, thank you. Let's get a quick response from Stefan. We've got other callers, other people. Stefan, comment on the last two callers.
It's politics, and, you know, my cuts are painful. Your cuts aren't. You know, it's very difficult to take away programs, especially when it's the United States is a country that is so invested in the military. We admire the military so much. They've become our national heroes. And that makes it very painful. So, you know, it's not going to be easy.
Let's go to Marshall. Marshall calling on this topic from Iowa City. Hi, Marshall. What do you have to say?
Hi. Well, I really agree with Rob. I mean, that was exactly what I was thinking. But I wanted to address the statement about the plane, the mechanical plane with choking off people's oxygen. That's the F-22, I think you're alluding to, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's very important to have air superiority. We can cut a lot of things, but not maintaining air superiority would be a huge mistake. And that's not coming from someone who's insisting we don't cut anything. We have to make cuts. I know that to save money. We have to do that. But the F-22 is extremely important to maintain our ability to control the air. We can bring down other things. We can cut other things as long as we keep air superiority.
Marshall,
what do you guys think about that?
Okay, Marshall, thanks from Iowa City. A response to that, Stefan, and I want to make sure, Lindsay, you have a chance to respond to the last three callers here. Stefan, since it's addressed directly to you.
We may need the F-22 Raptor, or we may not need it. I mean, we don't know what the combat of the future is. Rumsfeld redesigned the U.S. military when he came in 2001 to make it a light fighting force. We would never use large numbers of troops. The Rumsfeld doctrine was light in combat. It turned out to be a total disaster in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we had to armor everything up because we didn't know what the next war would be, which is what we've been doing for the last 10 years or more. So we don't know if the Raptor is going to be the crucial necessary piece of equipment that we have in the future, because we don't know who our adversary is going to be. It may be that it'll be cruise missiles or drones, or it may be, you know, satellite laser weapons that hover over our enemy and fire deadly laser beams down on them.
Lindsey Kahn, we haven't let you into the mix here. Three callers and Stefan's comment on what you've heard. What are your thoughts now?
Sure, I'll go backwards. You know, in one sense, I very much agree with Stefan in that, and I agree with Yocola too. We definitely need to maintain air superiority. We simply don't know how to do that necessarily, right? But that being said, it's always more expensive to come up with new stuff than it is to just go ahead and finish the old stuff. It's, you know, the sunk costs fallacy is that, well, this doesn't seem to be working. Let's try something new. No, I mean, you've already, that money is gone. You should just fix what you've got. But, you know, the question that your second caller brought up, Rob, this is a fantastic point, and the short answer to your question is no, there is no consensus issue that everyone can agree to cut. If there were, we would have done it by now. And everyone has a pet project. Everyone can agree that things need to be cut, but every time you identify a specific thing to be cut, you've just identified a constituency that doesn't want it cut. And if they can be loud enough, no one will cut that. And the big problem is the way that congressional incentives are set up. You know, as two of your callers pointed out, I think your first caller in particular pointed this out, the Pentagon keeps on getting things that they didn't ask for, things that they've specifically said they don't want, things that don't work, but they're being built in some congressman's district, and he's not going to cut them, right? So, you know, unfortunately, that is the nature of congressional politics, is that there is no consensus issue, and everything will be a fight. To get to what your first caller was talking about in terms of, you know, why are we always cutting personnel and trying to cut personnel costs? I completely understand that. And, you know, it is extremely important that we have a well-compensated military. A volunteer military must be well taken care of and well compensated. And morally speaking, it's important to do this too. However, that being said, as I mentioned before, personnel costs are going through the roof. And what I mean by that is cost per person, cost per service member. We must bring them under control. They are taking up an enormous chunk of the entire military budget, and that's just not sustainable. We cannot have the best paid military in the world and not have them have ammunition to train with or time, you know, enough gas to practice flying. That's not okay. So we have to do something about personnel costs. At the same time, absolutely, it would be great if we could cut all of these programs that don't do anything or that are, you know, cost overruns. But this is an unwieldy beast, and it's not always easy to do that. And again, with the congressional politics going on, sometimes you just end up cutting the thing that the fewest people are complaining about.
Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to make sure I got to Stefan, especially on another bit of international politics on our horizon, because I know, Stefan, you grew up in South America, in Colombia, and follow the politics of South America closely. This week, the United States ordering three Venezuelan diplomats to leave in reprisal for President Nicolas Maduro's expulsion of three American embassy staff accused of fomenting unrest that's killed at least 13 people. We hear about all this unrest in Venezuela. We haven't got much time for you. 2 minutes, Stefan. What's going on and what's your take on it?
Well, Venezuela is in a deep crisis. We don't report on it in the United States for some reason. Our news media can only handle one Ukraine at a time. And mm-hmm. Venezuela is potentially a second Ukraine, hopefully not a second Syria. But, you know, the Venezuelan government has frittered away all of the wealth of the country. The country is broke. The redistribution of wealth and income has pleased the poorest people in the country, but the middle class is absolutely furious. There are shortages of everything. There is no foreign currency left in the Venezuelan treasury, and the inflation rate is out of control. And under those circumstances, you get a lot of very, very unhappy, angry people, and they're in the streets. We don't get the reports here, but, you know, Caracas is on fire. Barquisimeto is on fire. There are student protests and middle-class protests all over the country now. And this is a real crisis for the Venezuelan government because they face the same kind of unhappiness among a very active group of people that probably the Ukrainian government did.
What can or should the U.S. do, also keeping an eye on the fact that the U.S. has been in decades mixed up in South American politics and not always on the nice side of things?
Well, The Obama policy is not to do anything, and that's probably what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Because why? Because anything the U.S. Might do would be seen against the backdrop of what has been done in South America in by the U.S.
No, just because Obama doesn't have a foreign policy. I mean, he doesn't have one for Syria or any other place either. And so doing nothing seems to be, you know, the best thing is to say, well, we're going to wait and not get ourselves involved in this. And the Venezuelan opposition is furious and angry because, you know, the Iranians and the Cubans and others are deeply involved, okay. You know, supporting the Chavez government and the aftermath of Chavez. So,
Lindsey Kahn, 30 seconds on Venezuela, if you'd like it.
Sure. I agree with Stefan's assessment of the situation. I think if you're asking for policy suggestions, it wouldn't hurt anything to get together with the OAS and make a statement about the need to work things out diplomatically. That would give some moral support to the protesters. And I think it might be a good idea to get another OAS member, maybe Argentina, to offer to mediate. But I don't really see much for the U.S. to do right now.
Okay. Lindsey Kahn, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, currently on leave, working at the Pentagon and an International Affairs Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you, too, for a lively hour. A lot of important news out there. Thank you so much, Lindsey and Stefan, for your analysis.
Always great to chat, Ben.
Thanks. So much happy news to talk about.
Also, thanks for the great input from our callers, listener callers. Tomorrow on this program, neuropsychiatrist and bestselling author Dr. Daniel Siegel talking about the teenage brain. We hope you'll tune in. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.